This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman. Part of plantation life in Hawaii's earlier days was the plantation store. Because workers were sometimes paid only once a month and often didn't have cars, the extended credit and free delivery of plantation stores were pretty significant services. But after World War II, labor organizers won higher wages on the sugar plantations, and more workers could afford cars. Plantation stores went into decline, and the so-called cash-and-carry stores took off. Thanks to our partners at the Center for Oral History at the University of Hawaii, we have voices this morning from four small business people who owned stores on Maui in the 1930s and 40s. The interviews were recorded in 1979, and they start with Mei Itamura. She was born in Nahiku, Maui, to Japanese parents, moving to Kaheka with her family in 1919. She quit school 4 years later after her father died and worked pumping gasoline, being a store clerk, and then she was a bookkeeper at Maui Dry Goods. She eventually was put in charge of the Maui Dry Goods liquor department and opened her own store in 1937, the Paia Liquor Store. She says she was the first woman in Hawaii to be issued a liquor license. And again, a reminder, these oral histories were recorded 40 years ago, and while we've been able to clean them up a bit, you may have to listen just a little harder, especially at the beginning.
In 1937, you decided to start your own business. Mm-hmm. No. Why did you make that decision?
Well, I read once in the magazine that the best way to make something of your life is to be self-employed. You be the highest paid, woman in the whole world. More you sell, you make more money, see? And you, while you work in the store, it's same salary. You can't advance more than what they do.
How did you get the building such a store?
Oh, that I rented one small place right in Lopaia. Then after a while, I opened another one on this side.
Two. Yeah, two. Did you feel sure that you were going to make good money in your own business?
When I started?
Mm-hmm.
No, I wouldn't know because I heard this Maui Dry Goods main stockholder. He didn't want me to get the license because I'm a young girl and then nobody in Hawaii gets that license. And he said, I shouldn't get the license, see? Because I'm too young to run a store.
You're about 32 years old, yeah? Did you feel at that time that you were qualified?
Sure, I know what I'm doing. After I got the license, I didn't worry because I know I can run the store. That's the easy thing.
Were there other liquor stores in Lower Paia at that time when you started?
When I started, I don't think there was any except the Maui Dry Goods one.
Mm.
And then when the war came, there was Japanese fella that had a small liquor store, but he got closed down because he was alien, you see.
All the time during the war, the soldiers were allowed to buy liquor.
Yeah, but they didn't stay long though after that.
So you said that they would clean you out of your stock.
Yeah, one day's time.
One day, like how much gross would you make during the war?
I sold, I think the highest was 36,000.
In one day?
Yeah. Because cases by cases,
So you said that you think you accomplished your goal in life.
Yeah.
So what was that goal?
Take good care of my own family, make them happy and then help them, put them through school as much as I can. At the same time, make some money, take care of myself. Because in this life, you have to be independent, You don't want people to pass over you and, this old lady, we don't want to stay with her, but we have to take care of her and all that, I think if you take care of yourself and know what you do in your life, set one goal, then you'll get it somehow.
Mei Itamura, she got it done, the first woman in Hawaii to get a liquor license back in 1937 when she opened her own place, the Paia Liquor Store. Masakazu Shimoto was born on the plantation camp, Camp Number 6 in Pu'unene in 1911. His father founded Maui Shokai, one of the big five Japanese stores in Kahului. The clientele was mostly Filipino, kampong workers who were paid only after their crops were harvested. Masakazu eventually took over operations of the store with his brothers, the business history that he knew well.
My father was the first to trust Filipino. See, we had Nihonjin Shokai, Onishi Shokai, then we had Ikeda, and then Paiya Mercantile. Paiya Nihonjin Shokai, they used to call it. That's 5 there, see? And with us, we had 6. So a lot of competition.
5 of you were all in
Kahului.
Mm-hmm. And you all sold the same type of merchandise?
Yeah, only we sold bicycles that were nobody sold. Then we sold RCA phonograph, which nobody sold. I think that's the only difference. Then we went into the Filipino business. We gave up Japanese, only a few handful of Japanese customers.
What did your father do to, you know, get the trust of the Filipino?
We had a good Filipino salesman. He's the one, not my father, the salesman. In those days, plantation had what you call a compound money. That's, you know, they take care of the field.
Every 2 years.
Yeah, they take care of the field by themselves. And then after harvest, if you have good tonnage, you make good money. Those people we have to carry. I know some of them we carry for about $900-$800 those days, you know.
So in 2 years' time, while they were waiting for their
Yeah, then we collected our money.
So sometimes the bill would be
$800? Oh, yeah, I remember for $800. They trusted that store so much, they put their life savings inside. Every payday put savings. So we had, just like the bank, passbook, keep the account, you know. That's why we could carry, you know, those people that every 2 years pay us. If not, we cannot carry. We had that extra cash to carry them along. You try to get a couple, maybe 50 people like that waiting for compound money, yeah? You can't pay the wholesaler in the end, you know.
Did the other stores like Ikeda and Kobayashi, did they do that kind of thing too?
Save money?
Yeah.
You mean people save? No, the Filipino, man. Japanese didn't have those savings accounts already. They would go to the bank, yeah? The newcomers, Filipinos. They were saying Maui Shokai is safer than the bank. My father said we had quite a sum of that Filipino money, you know, saved. But he said not one they failed to pay back. We both said we paid everybody, every cent.
Did you have many compound people not pay you?
No, most of them pay, compound people. They're about the most trustworthy, yeah? Because after all, you're carrying them for almost 2 years, yeah? Of course, if they're short of income, then you have to carry them for another 2 years. But if it wasn't for Filipino, I think maybe Maui Shokai gone already. Too much competition.
Masakazu Shimoto talking about the competition that would eventually be a factor when Maui Shokai closed its doors in 1973. We're listening to some oral histories this morning of early shopkeepers in Hawaii in the 1930s and 1940s. People like George Guerrero, who was an immigrant to Hawaii. He was born in Ilocos Norte in the Philippines in 1909, leaving for Hawaii when he was 17. He was a live-in clerk at the Nagatani store, then worked at the Camp 5 store before opening his own shop in Wailuku in 1946. He ran the Guerrero store for 24 years, retiring and closing up shop in 1970.
When did you first think about working in a store?
I was encouraged by my friend who was working in the store. That changed my mind that I had to go, that I go and work in the store. And then he was explaining to me that you stay in the shade, the only thing you do is carry 100-pound rice, 100-pound of feed, you know. Mm-hmm. So he told me, I don't mind because I can do that, stay in the shade. And he told me, rain or shine, you can work because you stay inside the store. That's why that encouraged me to go work.
What was the name of the store that you worked in? That
was Nagatani store in Waikapu, Wailuku.
Wailuku.
Did you continue to live in the Punini camp while you worked in the store?
No, they had a house for me. They gave me the house where I was staying. I did not pay anything on my board. See, because I work, I just stay in that house, and then go eat in the store. They give me free food.
What made you decide to start your own business?
Well, at that time I was working in the plantation store. I know the prices of the wholesale, and I know the percentage of retail. So I was thinking, if I go make my store and I can sell so much, I know I can make it. Because I had been working hard in the plantation store. If I work hard the same way as I do, I should say, then I know I can make it. That's why it makes my mind that I try my luck to make my own business.
At that time, had a lot of plantation stores and then had a lot of Japanese-run stores. Yeah. What made you, did you think that you could get your percentage of customers?
Well, at the time I know, because I told them that I could get plenty of them, because I told them the price that we sell in the store will be the same price I will sell you. You can compare, and if you don't want, well, it's up to you, but I greatly appreciate if you will patronize on me. So that'll, if the same price, no problem, we buy from you. So at that time, I have all different nationality. I have Filipinos, I have Japanese, I have Chinese, Hawaiian, all kind of ethnic.
All the way up until 1970, you were
in there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever want your sons or daughters to continue the store?
I tried to convince them that one of them should carry over, but they said the hours that they're putting in there, they said it's too long, so they want to work only 8 hours and go home, and that's all.
George Guerrero, clearly not a man of 8-hour work days. Neither was Alice Saito Govea. She was born in 1918 on Maui, where her father was an independent pineapple grower. She moved to Haiku when she was 13 to live with her uncle, who was a storekeeper. In 1948, she opened the Economy Store in Lower Paia, running the shop for nearly 30 years.
You said that when you first opened, you attracted a lot of Filipinos.
Filipinos, yeah.
And a lot of Portuguese after you got married.
Yeah, Portuguese,
to your husband,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it mainly because of what you sold that attracted Filipinos and Portuguese?
In the beginning, well, Filipinos as a whole, if you treat them right, they are very faithful. The Hawaiians also, yeah. Our Japanese are more, they stick to one. But later on, well, they all came my way, yeah. And I had all nationalities in the store.
When you first started in 48, what was, for example, one day, your gross volume of sales?
Yes, I think about $50, eh?
Oh, $50.
Uh-huh. Later on.
Later on, 7 years later, when you added that open vegetable bin,
yeah,
you were selling pork and fish and so forth, about how much?
Went up to maybe about $500.
And then when you closed the store in 1975, about that time, about how much?
Well, some days was 1,000 something.
When did you start to notice a decline in your sales?
When the big markets came up. And the distance, when people started to work in Lahaina, you see. Like before, they thought, it's so far to go to Kaholoi or Wailuku. Then they started working in Lahaina. Distance don't mean anything today.
What about when Dream City came up and people started moving out of the camps?
That's when we felt it also. But that was, I would say, between 5 and 10 years after I started the business. Mm-hmm. That made a lot of difference too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So all the merchants, did they start to feel it?
Yes, and some have given up. And right now, well, Paia isn't too bad because there are a lot of these Maine folks moved up Kapokoloa, where we used to be, and Haikuei. These are the kind of things they use. They're eating my apples, especially now. Then I say, oh, did you pay for your apple? I said, no, this, I don't need to pay for it because God made this. And I said, well, is that so? Well, when God pays my expense, my taxes, and my electricity and whatever, yeah, the day God pays me, then I'll tell you, you can help yourself. Until that day, you must pay for your things.
We're listening to some oral histories this morning from storekeepers and shop owners in Hawaii's earlier days, the 1930s, the 1940s. Our final retail story today comes a bit later, and it's not a tale from the plantations, but from urban Honolulu, all about the founding of the ABC stores. Sidney Kosasa was born in 1919 in Palolu Valley. His Japanese parents ran a grocery store there, and he grew up working in the store. He started his career as a pharmacist in St. Louis in 1943, coming back to Hawaii the next year to work at a local drugstore chain. In 1949, he opened Kaimuki Pharmacy on Wailai and eventually owned 8 drugstores on the island. In 1965, he went to a chain drugstore meeting in Florida and saw firsthand the business that convenience stores were starting to do with tourists. He came back to Honolulu and opened the first ABC store in Waikiki. By 1975, he had 7 of them. 10 years later, he had 27. When this interview was done with Sidney Kosasa in 2001, there were 60 ABC stores with seeds originally planted by his mother.
You said once that your mother was the one who suggested that you go into pharmacy.
Pharmacy, yeah.
When was this?
That was when I was going to high school. And that's when I was working in the grocery store too, see. And my mother is always kind of, she's a good businesswoman, see. So she says, you know, because there was Stewart Pharmacy and Hollister Drugstore on the Wildlife Avenue. She says, hey, they make more money than the grocery store, see. So she wants to take a pharmacy and open up a drugstore, see. So, That's how she gave me that idea, see? So.
And how did you feel about that idea?
I thought that was pretty good because I grew up in a grocery store, so know the business, see? So I said, well, working in a drugstore, all I do is take a pharmacy, you know, and get a pharmacy license, you could open a drugstore, you know. So then I kind of made up my mind that, eventually I'll open up a drugstore, see.
How did you get the idea to start ABC?
When I went to this chain drug meeting in Miami. At that time, we were back in 1965, see. The big hotels were all in Miami. It was a little kind of a shopping mall in Miami, see. And yet, we noticed that, see, all the people, you know, all around there, they were going to the shopping area to go shop, see. So we figured, see, Waikiki, one of these days, going to have a lot of hotels around. And then, you know, we'll be able to got to look around for locations, so we'll anchor ourselves with our shops around there. And that's how we got started on it. So when we came back, she and I, we started looking all around Waikiki. There was hardly anybody around Waikiki. Only Hale Kulani was one of the Royal Hawaiian Hotel and Moana Hotel. That was the only hotel there. I figured, gee, Hawaii going to be one of these days like Miami. So when we started out with Health and Beauty, so that's what they say, ABC Discount Drugstore first. So the same thing counts as the drugstore too, you know, ABC Drugstore. You know. Since we carry a lot of drugs and cosmetics, and of course we carry
groceries, the fast food. Now we carry everything.
How did you come up with the name ABC?
Tourists that come from the mainland, from Japan, they cannot remember the Hawaiian name or anything. So why don't we pick up an easy name so that anybody can remember? So that's how we pick up ABC.
ABC founder Sidney Kosasa and the story of the naming of the ABC stores. Why do I think that's going to wind up as a backyard quiz someday? If you have a story about stores in Hawaii, any thoughts about what you just heard, you can give a call to our talkback line. Leave us a message. Number to call there, 808-792-8217. Our thanks, as always, to the Center for Oral History at the University of Hawaii, and mahalo nui to Daviana McGregor, Lurline McGregor, and Micah Mizukami for all their work on this project and all our other collaborations.
Coming Saturday, June 15, to the Atherton Studio. Join HPR for an evening of pop tunes, bluegrass, and more with jazz ensemble Constant as the Moon, featuring the evocative sound of the erhu, the two-stringed Chinese fiddle, in a whole new context. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Amoresco.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we explore the history of one of Hawaii's iconic beer brands. Established in 1898 by the Honolulu Brewing and Malting Company, Primo rose to prominence as one of the first Hawaiian-brewed beers to gain widespread popularity across the islands. Following Prohibition, the Honolulu Brewing and Malting Company was renamed the Hawaii Brewing Company, and by the 1950s, Primo had become one of the island's best-selling beers. In 1963, the Schlitz Brewing Company bought the rights to the brand, moved the bottling operations to Aiea. At its peak, more than 400,000 barrels of Primo were produced in Hawaii each year, but the thriving production would not last. In 1979, the brewing of Primo would be relocated to Southern California. By 1997, then-parent Strobe Brewing would cease production of Primo altogether. The brand languished for years until 2007, when a prominent beer conglomerate purchased the rights to Primo and revived what is now marketed as Hawaii's original beer. Now, for today's backyard quiz, which beer company currently owns the rights to the Primo name? If you know the answer, 941-3689 is the number to call, or toll-free 877-941-3689. First one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Coming Saturday, June 8th to HPR's Atherton Studio. An evening of revolutionary music inspired by the 1960s and 70s. Oahu native Peter Apo brings folk music alive in a new way. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Amoresco.
How many times must a man look up before?
If you are in your car right now, there is at least some small piece of your brain that somewhere is considering parking. Now, if you're lucky, you already know where you're going to park when you reach your destination. But the topic is a point of aggravation. And if you think that, you're not alone. It actually touches on a lot of other urban issues. And our contributing editor, Neil Milner, is here with some thoughts on that in today's edition of The Long View. And Neil, this makes sense when you think about it, but I got to admit, I hadn't thought about parking quite in that way as a key to a lot about life in the city.
Well, first, let me say that I'm parked at a meter, so I may have to leave this interview early so I don't get a ticket. Not true. I'm legally paid up, and there's plenty of time.
Good to know.
Yes, it turns out that parking has a lot of serious ramifications. You get a sense of it here, how the issue comes up and what it's related to. I mean, right now we have an argument over someone who owns streets and is trying to charge for parking, and that raises all kinds of stuff. You have the issue of where do you park when you have affordable housing? Do you as a incentive to developers, one of the things here is that you don't have to build as many parking spaces, and we'll get back to that. There's a huge one nationally, and this is just beginning to develop, with driverless cars. If you have driverless cars, you lose a lot of revenue if they don't use parking meters, and you lose a lot of revenue from not being able to collect overdue parking tickets. It's well over $100 million, let's say, in Los Angeles a year. So all of those things are like that. What Donald Shoup did, Donald Shoup is really the guru of reexamining parking. He's a planning professor at an urban studies professor at UCLA. He wrote a book called The High Cost of Free Parking a few years ago, and he became kind of a guru because he got cities all over the world to re-examine the conventional wisdom about parking and re-examine a kind of implicit pro-parking bias to say there are lots of costs that are involved. It affects sustainability. It affects development. It affects even the level of conflict in a place. And so now there is much more of at least a consideration of alternatives to having as much parking as possible, as much free parking as possible.
You know, there are some places, in fact, in Asia, I know in Beijing and in parts of Tokyo, if you are wanting to buy a car, they call it proof of parking. Mm-hmm. You have to show that you have a place to park.
A parking space,
before you buy it.
Yeah, there's a lot of assumptions like that. They vary by country. Right now, Amsterdam, for instance, is eliminating 10,500 parking spaces over the next 5 years. The interesting thing is there doesn't seem to be any conflict over this. Mm. And some of the ways they're doing this is that people used to have, if you had a permit to park downtown,
right.
When your permit expires, you're losing it. If you die, it's not like a Green Bay Packers season ticket. It goes to your people who inherit it. It isn't inherited at all. You go and it goes. So it does vary. And the United States has been, I think, fairly reluctant to think along these lines. And if you think about why, there's a fairly obvious reason, right? The development since World War II and even before has been toward the suburbs. Mm-hmm. If you want to get people in the suburbs, this is true in almost any place in the United States, you want to get people in the suburbs to continue to shop in the city and try to save the central core, which they weren't always very successful to do. What do? You have to offer parking. And as people began to buy more than one car, parking became more of an issue. So it became not just a fringe benefit, but a necessity in the eyes of most urban planners to have sufficient parking inside a building for both workers and particularly for people who live in the high-rises. You've driven around here. You can see the old buildings where there's way too many cars on the streets, right? These people are constantly driving around. The newer buildings, it's not the case.
The expectations, though, on the part of number one, people driving, but also it's an interesting point on the expectations of government, of the tax revenue that is represented by those parking meters. And certainly, you know, here in Honolulu, you've seen in terms of increase of charging.
That's right. And one of the things he says is that, look, I'm not telling everybody to eliminate all these parking. What I'm trying to get people to do is to think about the costs of offering parking because it's not free. And as I say, there's sustainability costs. There's a lot of energy that's used driving around looking for a parking space. People fight about them all the time. He says the conflict comes from the reptilian brain, really, where it's about territory. And so you lose essentially your self-control. And I think he's onto something there. But the important thing is to have some way to think about how can you incorporate this kind of thinking, which I'm sure people in Honolulu have thought about. I'm not telling the urban planners here. It just isn't that visible to the layperson. One of the things he says about parking meters, he says if you're going to have them, there are two things that you should do, one of which is to vary the charge for the meter in terms of the daytime. The heavier the meter is used, it's like these toll
it's like
roads.
Congestion
parking. The more you charge. The other thing he said that has been very successful in getting merchants, let's say, to be willing to see their parking reduced is to earmark the parking meter revenue to a particular neighborhood that's getting impacted by losing parking. Uh-huh. So they would promise the merchants, say, look, if we give up these spaces, we're going to collect this, you're going to lose this revenue, or the revenue that there is there, we will now give to the neighborhood for, let's say, redevelopment. And that's so that he's obviously not against all parking, although there's a great picture of him riding a bicycle. He looks like a professor at Oxford. It's perfect. It really is like central casting. But he's a very smart man. He's very... he's able to get people to examine what's conventional wisdom, and that's an extraordinarily difficult thing to do. So that parking is now looked at in terms of a cost or both a cost and a benefit. And I think you're going to see that increasingly thought about here. I don't have any formula to say how much we can reduce or how much we should increase, but that clearly is an issue. Clearly more of an issue as we build more in the urban core. Kapolei, not so much. There's plenty of parking out there.
And also not to always obsess about Oahu, because for neighbor islands, parking is an issue in a slightly different way urban Honolulu. But certainly going to that point that you say, that sort of a pro-parking bias or an assumption that, of course we need X number of spaces. Mm-hmm. Maybe not.
No, that's true. By the way, one of the assumptions that we've made over the years is that you subsidize parking, but you don't necessarily subsidize people who take the bus. My daughter works in Portland. Government employees get a bus pass, so that there is that disincentive. Otherwise, what you're doing, parking is another way to subsidize the people with money compared to people without money. On the other hand, if you don't have parking, like, say, the buildings that are going to be put up around Kaka'ako and around the Ala Moana Shopping Center and up Keamoku, if you don't have parking, is there enough incentive for people who are going to live in affordable housing to have good public transportation, which would require perhaps rail to actually operate? Or are you essentially just writing them off? Is this another place where the people without money end up carrying the load?
Requiring a reimagination.
It is a reimagination. You're right.
And a reimagining of transportation.
Yes, and I think we really have to reimagine Honolulu. People are not used to thinking of this place as an urban place yet, even though it's always been a city. But the kind of urbanization that's developing now, and part of it is to think about things like parking.
Neil Milner, thanks for helping that thinking along.
Sure.
He's retired professor of political science and contributing editor of our segment, The Long View. The Honolulu City Council has approved nearly $23 million to help the city's homeless situation. That's the focus of today's reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Politics and opinion editor Chad Blair joins us with some details. And Chad, this approach gives some latitude to different communities to use the money as they see fit. That's the idea?
Yeah, and good morning, Bill. Yeah, the idea is coming from Councilwoman Kimberly Pine, and this $23 million is going to be divided equally among the nine districts on Oahu. There's an additional $2 million going to Waianae by the Waianae Coast, which is actually part of Kim Pine's district. And according to the councilwoman, she says each district has its own challenges, own possible solutions for dealing with homelessness. What works in Waianae may not work in Wahiwa, she said. And you can just imagine how easily things might be different from Hawaii Kai to the North Shore, from Ewa Beach to Waimanalo. So that's the idea, is let each district get a lump sum and decide how to best use it.
And there's, of course, there's a certain basic logic in that, but there's also a set of assumption that goes with that, that in each of these districts there are specific ideas that are not only worthy of funding, but also ready for that stage of funding.
Right. It really depends on what the district's particular needs are, where they are. And by the way, this money can go to support acquisition of facilities for homeless, to lease land, to even develop or renovate existing homeless shelters. Out in Waianae, for example, and we're using that example only because it's a prominent location. Civil Beat did an entire series on the harbor camp that's out there, primarily Native Hawaiian. They're looking at developing housing, but also hygiene facilities for people that need specifically to take a shower, to use the bathroom, and also maybe to do laundry. Nonprofits out in Waianae are delivering health and other services. And that may not necessarily be exactly what's needed in other areas. I might just add that another thing that's being discussed among council members is, what are other cities doing? What mm-hmm. are other municipalities? I think we were just reading how Los Angeles has just shockingly saw their numbers go up. But another California city, San Francisco, has things that they call pop-up shelters. Another term is lift zones or a navigation center. And again, to connect people with social services and counseling and other matters. So Seattle's another city facing a crisis, but also a potential model for Honolulu.
Now, in terms of that, when that comes to the city government more broadly and involving the mayor's office at some point, what's the attitude over there on this?
Well, it kind of depends on who you ask. This is overall part of a $1 billion capital budget that was approved by the full council yesterday. There is $13 million in addition to this $23 million that we're talking about being divided up among the nine districts, $13 million going specifically to programs like Housing First. And we know that's something that has been proven to work. But, the Caldwell administration pointed out, we tried this approach a couple of years ago, back when Ernie Martin was council chair. I think the figure at that time was about $2 million for each district. And according to the administration, that money wasn't necessarily spent. In fact, in many cases, it was not. There were some exceptions. So why try it again? But of course, Ernie Martin is now gone, and others are leading the council. And so there was some concern that maybe that's not the best place. That's a pretty big chunk of change, $23 million, that could maybe be spent on other areas for affordable housing and homelessness.
Well, and it is going to be interesting to see what the individual council members then do in each of the districts, because at this point they have asked for, give us this ability, give us this freedom to be able to do this, and now they're going to have to come up with the specifics to go with that, right?
I think so. You have to justify the spending. You have to have accountability to show that it's been spent wisely. But another thing to think about is there was a report just this week. It was actually the lead story in the Star Advertiser. We had it on our website as well. 373 homeless people on Oahu died over the last 5 years. That's 2014 through 2018. 2018 was actually the largest single figure ever for us. 90 people dying who were homeless, classified as homeless at the time of their death. We already know what the per capita numbers are for Honolulu. Shockingly high, perhaps not as bad as Los Angeles, but I think this only illustrates more and more how serious this is, and this idea of dividing the money for each district is an idea to give more local control to solving what is really a backyard issue for so many of us.
Thanks, Chad. That was Civil Beat's politics and opinion editor, Chad Blair. You can find the story by Christine Jedra on civilbeat.org. Thank you.
Aloha, I'm Susan Wright from Becker Communications. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you to name the current owner of the iconic Hawaiian beer Primo, known for the silhouette portrait of King Kamehameha on each bottle and its claim as Hawaii's original beer. Primo's had a long and turbulent history here in Hawaii. The label was involved in many buyouts, rebrandings, relocations over the years. Primo was brewed in Hawaii until 1979 before production ceased altogether in 1997. Until the Pabst Brewing Company purchased the rights to the Primo name in the year 2000, resuming production of the brew in 2007. And James in Barbers Point called in, knew the answer to that. That is today's quiz. If you have a quiz, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. What's your favorite local beer? And would it make a difference to you if you found out that beer actually came from the mainland? Kona Brewing Company has moved to settle a class action lawsuit alleging that the brewery misled consumers with marketing that was themed with Hawaii, but not the beer. Kona's bottled and canned beers actually are produced on the mainland. HPR's Ryan Finnerty has been following that story.
Hey, Bill. So, yeah, a lot of people out there are probably familiar with these beers from Kona Brewing Company. They've got names like Big Wave, Golden Ale, Fire Rock, Hanalei IPA, and Pipeline Porter. And as you heard, some of them are named for actual places in Hawaii. Some of them are more just evocative of the feel of Hawaii. And the issue is, as you mentioned in that intro, that none of those beers, if you buy them in a bottle or a can, are actually produced in Hawaii. The company does have a production facility in Kona that a lot of people have probably been to in a restaurant, but that only produces draft beer. And so that fact spurred a class action lawsuit filed by a California man in 2017. He alleged that Craft Beer Alliance, which is the parent company of Kona Brewing Company, misled him into thinking that the beer he purchased, it was a six-pack in that case, actually came from Hawaii. And last week, CBA, that parent company of Kona, moved to settle the lawsuit without admitting any wrongdoing.
So if it is draft beer, Kona draft beer, it's brewed in Hawaii, but the bottles and cans not. And that, in terms of Kona Brewing having some long history here in Hawaii, relatively speaking.
Yeah, and so if you drink draft Kona, if you buy it in a bar or get a keg of it in Hawaii, it came from the Hawaii facility. If you buy a draft on the mainland, that's not necessarily the case. But the brewery has been in operation since the mid-1990s on Hawaii Island. That's when they first opened up. But as you can imagine, like producing anything in Hawaii, it's pretty expensive and logistically challenging to do it. Everything has to be shipped in, things like hops, grains, you know, the raw materials of beer to cans and bottles to actually package it. And even all that large brewing equipment. We heard last week from the owner of Maui Brewing about the challenges they're having with getting brewing equipment in with the tariffs and everything. So when it came time to expand their production, Kona Brewing Company looked at contracting some of that out to existing facilities on the mainland. This is a pretty common tactic for a lot of brewers to use. And I spoke with Andy Baker, who listeners might recognize from our pledge drives. He used to work in HPR's corporate underwriting department, but he's actually been a longtime member of the Hawaii brewing industry for about 35 years. And he gave me a little bit of the background as to how Kona made that decision.
The way that they were going to be financially successful was to increase production of draft beer. So number one, they need space. Number two, they also built their brewery restaurant over there at the same time. So carving up the space, something really had to go. Financially, when you looked at the situation, you put two shipping containers side by side in Oakland, California. The shipping container that's got, let's say, 2,500 cases of empty bottles next to a container that's got 1,500 cases full of beer. The container that's got full beer ships at 40% less shipping rate than the container that's got empty bottles. So I think Kona at the time looked at that and said, we've got to delete space to make room for this restaurant and increase our draft production. So what gives? And I think what gave was a bottling line.
And Bill, you might, as I did, be scratching your head about how that shipping math worked out.
Boy, that's astounding. Full beer ships at 40% less of a shipping rate than the container that has empty bottles.
Yeah, and so what Andy said is that the shipping rates are not just based off of the weight of what's in it. They're based off of the quantity that you're bringing in. Uh-huh. And so you can imagine if you're bringing in the materials to produce all your beer, mm-hmm. you're bringing in a lot more empty bottles, let's say, than if you were just bringing in some beer to sell in Hawaii.
Right.
You're bringing in a comparatively fewer number of containers, so they're priced differently. And so that's kind of how that weird math works out. And even on the mainland, where brewers can truck their products, they don't need to worry about shipping it. This is a pretty common practice to outsource production to a facility that's closer to maybe where one of your markets is or that's mm-hmm. already in existence. And one of the reasons is that this is a very competitive industry. The latest figures show that there are more than 7,000 breweries in the United
wow.
States. Most of them are pretty small, and you can think there's a lot of breweries around the islands that are maybe it's just a restaurant that produces some beer mm-hmm. or they just sell it in-house, but that all counts as a brewery. So to compete in this very competitive space, brewers need to be very efficient. And I talked to Bart Watson, who's the chief economist for the Brewers Association, about how they go about doing that.
I think it's putting a lot of pressure on the breweries that rely on broad distribution to compete, and particularly those that distribute all across the country, or at least a long way away from where their brewery is located. One of the challenges those breweries face is it costs more and more to do business in a competitive environment. You need more salespeople. And so, breweries are trying to find ways that they can still, grow and be competitive, without, breaking the bank or taking on a ton of debt. So, we see breweries who are looking for partners, either, selling out to a large brewer or forming brewery groups, or taking on a private equity partner. And we see breweries who, if they're still in expansion mode, looking to, contract somewhere else so that they can, see what the market size is without taking on all that debt and all that risk of expanding by building a huge brewery.
And so, Bill, all that is to say, what Kona Brewing was doing was not at all abnormal, pretty common. What got them in trouble was that all their beer is marketed as Hawaii. It doesn't explicitly say brewed in Hawaii. That would have been an explicit problem. But, it's named after Hawaii. There's little vignettes about places in Hawaii. And they're not alone. German brewer Beck's got in trouble for this in 2013. They were sued after Anheuser-Busch bought the company and moved production of U.S. sales to St. Louis. Mm. And they were sued for still being marketed as a German beer. The law that covers this is the Federal Trade Commission Act, and it outlaws unfair or deceptive trade practices, but that's very much up to the interpretation of an agency that's enforcing it or a judge in this case. And so I spoke with Honolulu attorney Elijah Yip from the law firm Luminate Law to get a sense of how this law could be applied to this case.
Yeah, that's a tricky one because in this case, the plaintiff's argument was, look, your name says you're from Kona. And by implication, consumers would believe that that product, the beer that you're brewing, it comes from Kona or somewhere in Hawaii. So the test, the perspective to look at is what would a reasonable consumer think? How would they process the advertising copy, the claims that you're making? What would the reasonable consumer think? The case settles, so we won't know for sure who's right or who's wrong. But probably the argument was that by the plaintiffs at least that, hey, if I see your brand, Kona Brewing Company, putting out this beer, I'm going to pick it up at the store and I'm going to think that it's from Kona or somewhere in Hawaii. And if you don't do your job to tell me otherwise, then I've been tricked. I've been deceived. And that's considered deceptive trade practice.
And Bill, I should say, Elijah was not involved in that case at all. Mm-hmm. So that was purely outside analysis, and he didn't know that much about it. So just from reading the statute, that was his interpretation.
But that idea of using Hawaii as a brand when you're not all the way through with it.
Yeah, and it's interesting. There's actually a state law on the books that Andy Baker told me about. If you sell an alcoholic beverage in Hawaii, it needs to be fully produced in the state of Hawaii. So that's brewed, packaged, and all of that. Wouldn't apply to sales on the mainland, of course, but that, I guess, has never really been enforced. But so there, the company did move to settle this lawsuit, reported that it's about a $4.8 million settlement, and again, not acknowledging any wrongdoing in the case. Mm-hmm. They just expressed a desire to move forward. If this this settlement receives court approval, anyone who purchased Kona beer, not in draft form, but in six packs or cans, bottles, since February of 2013, will be eligible for a refund up to $20 per household.
But you need your receipts, right?
You actually don't. You can get up to $10 per household without receipts.
Ryan Finnerty. You can find his story online at hawaiipublicradio.org. He's producer here on The Conversation, doing stories for the shows as well. Ryan, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, a call-in show on garden pests. You can tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. Leave a comment in your voice, 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, on Facebook at The Conversation HPR, and Twitter at HI Conversation. That's it for today. Catherine Cruz back tomorrow with more of The Conversation. I'm Bill Dorman. Aloha.